What would it mean to live a life unconstrained? Welcome to Beyond the Rut, the podcast that shares encouraging stories and practical tools to help pull you out of your rut into a life worth living. In fact, we're the show about creating a life worth living in your faith, family, and career. I'm your host, Jerry Dugan, and in this episode, we're going to be joined by Australian expat Miles Wakeham. He does his work as a software engineer, but he's been in bands. He's living the life that he has constructed for himself and living out his dream. And so his question for all of us is, what would it be like if you designed a life unconstrained that you live beyond your rut into the life you've always dreamt of living? And that's what this show is about. So I wanted to bring to you somebody who really spoke my language, spoke your language in a sense, but with an Australian accent. You know, it's like, if you hear it from me all the time, you're like, yeah, that's cute. That's Jerry. You know, he always talks about this. However, when you hear it from somebody else who's saying the same thing, but with a different voice, sometimes it just rings a little bit louder. And that's my hope with this conversation. Had a great time talking with Miles. We talked about the weather. We talked about the difference between the United States and Mexico, where he currently resides. All those good things. What I'd like you to do right now is grab a notebook, grab a pen, sit back, relax, and take a listen to this conversation and take some notes for how you are going to design your life unconstrained and beyond the rut. Here we go. All right. Hey, Miles, hope you're doing well and that you got a nice sunny day there in Mexico.
Always sunny here, man. Always sunny.
And what part of Mexico are you in again? Like central. It's down south.
It's a town called San Miguel de Allende, which is in the almost direct center of Mexico. We're in the state of Guanajuato. We're about 3 hours bus ride north of Mexico City, and we're on the road to nowhere out here. We're living the dream, but no one knows we exist.
It was funny when you emailed me back last week when I sent out the confirmation and the updated link and all that, and you're like, hey, yeah, I'll be there. I'll be calling in from Mexico. And I was like, oh, man, he's on vacation. So I was thinking he's going to be in a hotel room, not his usual setup. And I was like, oh, you poor thing. And you're like, no, I live here, man. I'm like, oh, that's even cooler. Like permanent vacation in a way.
Yeah, something like that.
So from what I understand, you lived in Australia because you're Australian, you're an expat living in Mexico. You jokingly said with the occasional incursion into Arizona when you kind of want to raise up a stink over there for us. But you live in other places too, but you got this freedom to kind of live where you want, how you want. And I was hoping to just kind of dig into that. Like, what was life like in Australia before you became an expat? That's kind of the before story. Where Miles's origin story. There we go.
Well, I mean, I was born in the 60s, so I grew up, I guess, as a kid through the late 60s, early 70s. On the other side of the planet, Australia is somewhat unique. It's an individual country that very few people back in those days ever went to. So we were a very isolated community, and at the time when I grew up, there were probably only 10 to 15 million people living in a country with the landmass the size of the United States. So, you know, there were small cities, but there were few of them. They were far between. We lived in a world where community was everything. Everyone looked after each other. There was a lot of unwritten laws about how you behave. Everything had some sort of ceremony to it. Everyone was please and thank you. We were back in the old days, you know, it was like living probably in what the United States was in the 50s. And that's how I grew up. And I didn't know any better than that. The weird thing is that when you're living in a country where everything on the ground can kill you, which yes, literally it can, and don't go swimming because the jellyfish will get you or the sharks or whatever it was, you tend to take in your stride, and you learn at a very young age that the buck stops on your desk. You're responsible for everything you do. There's nobody's going to bail you out other than you. And if you get lucky, somebody might. But at the end of the day, really, you make careful choices in life and how you do things. With that said, there's also a natural sense in Australian, in the id, certainly at the generation I came from, of not necessarily trusting everything around you. It was kind of like you want to touch something and feel it to trust it. You don't trust what somebody's telling you because they usually, you know, they'll blow smoke up you and you don't need that. And at some point it's like, no, if I'm going to make a decision, it's going to be based on my own observation. So there's this natural at least with me, there was this natural sense of wanting to go out and actually see things for myself and experience things for myself at a very, very young age. And I was in a very weird upbringing. My parents were both concert pianists. They were musicians. I was told that I would be a musician from the age of five. They stuck a violin under my chin. And by the age of 11, I was in the state junior symphony orchestra. And my upbringing wasn't so much traditional in terms of school and, you know, reading, writing, math, English, that sort of thing. It was more music. And I was surrounded by people who had the experience of that, were touched by that. And that, you know, when I rebelled in my adolescent years, as we all do, it was rebelling to go and learn electric guitar just to piss my mother off. You know, that was my level of rebellion. The problem is that I was actually pretty good at it. So I ended up living in this sort of duality of being a musician or being, a proper member of society that's responsible. And my interpretation of that happened to end up in the world of electronics. I embraced electronics at a very young age and found myself accidentally buying one of the first ever personal computers that was ever invented in the late 70s, learning how to become a software developer, and then realizing, hey, I can make money on this. And so I started seeing with my own eyes that that would be a path. So I quit school before I finished even high school and became a software developer and made a lot of money, which is weird because all my friends, you know, who didn't quit school, who all got their graduate and went on to college or whatever, they were dead broke. Yeah. And here I was like, okay, this
I'm one
is
of those
cool.
guys.
I, you know, yeah, right. So having, I front loaded all these life experiences unexpectedly. I did not realize that, you know, I could have so much because I made a choice based on timing. I got into an emerging industry very early. That at the age of 25, when I eventually left Australia, I'd already written software for $5 billion defense contracts to build submarines. And I was writing software for the Attorney General's Department in my state and cryogenic freezer storage labs and all these crazy opportunities that nobody normally. And the weird thing is, I was writing software for the university I probably would have gone to if I stayed in school. They were paying me.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a very different and a weird perspective, you know. Then at 25, I accidentally found myself on the shores of California and ended up living there and came over as an immigrant with just a backpack of clothes, no right to work yet. I had to wait for that. And all of a sudden, I'm like, well, I can handle this. Just give me a computer. I can make money. And back in those days, I could. But I couldn't work legally, so I ended up going back to music and spent all my time running up and down the Sunset Strip in Hollywood trying to get gigs as a musician, and finally got involved in a band that actually ended up doing pretty well and got introduced to the whole audio industry, music industry in Hollywood, and then that sent me on another path. And then when I eventually got the right to work, I got a real day job, and I ended up working for a startup writing software because they didn't have any idea of my experience, or they couldn't validate it. They could, but they didn't want to. So the irony is I worked for this startup that was just a bunch of guys in these like mobile office trailers on a building site. And that company ended up becoming Amgen, which was the world's largest biotechnology corporation. Yeah. So they gave you a crap ton of stock options and we all became instant millionaires, you know. It was weird. It wasn't real. And that's the weird thing, right? From a guy who came from my background where everything is you got to touch it and feel it and see it and you want to be in control, to a world where this sort of stuff happens. It was like, this is alien and I couldn't believe it. And, you know, as it is, a lot of the world, certainly at that age, is sort of easy come, easy go. I ended up unexpectedly having to return back to Australia. My mother had a car accident. And in the end, I lost my marriage. I lost my money. I lost my health. I was in a massive car accident in the outback. And you went from hero to zero real fast. And that puts you through that sort of experience that you start realizing, well, maybe you shouldn't take everything for granted. And maybe you're not such a, you know, smart cookie after all, and the world's going to get you one way or another. So you better be prepared. And, you know, I guess I emerged out of that and ended up returning back to the United States to try to rebuild everything from nothing again. And it worked out. And then here's the weird thing. I mean, along this journey, this is a very solo experience, right? It's like nobody could understand or relate to it because it was alien, both in terms of foreign country. I spoke different to everybody else. I thought different to everybody else. And rather than try and to do the when in Rome and adapt to the Americana social, what I call the social mantra, I looked at it as an outsider and said, this is messed up. There's so many things here which do not equate in any way to my actual life experience that I had, that I had at some point to sort of question it and say, I know what you're telling me. I know you're telling me go to college when you're 18 and get a good job and study hard, and at 65 you retire. Here I was going, don't add up. And so I just said, maybe for you that's great, but for me, you know, you do you. I'll just keep doing what I did, and life ended up turning into a wonderful experience. And you know, and then eventually, you get to the, I think it's the end of the 2010s, around that period, and all of a sudden I started questioning. I thought things had gotten so entrenched in terms of that social mantra that everybody was never questioning anything anymore. And it wasn't the America that I moved to in 1989. It was a different country. It was a country of like foot soldiers that just followed in the steps of somebody else. They were like actors on somebody else's screenplay. They never wrote their own script. They just followed what the man told them to do. And they were not winning. The man was winning. They were living in the ivory towers and everybody else was paupers on the street. And I looked at it and I'm like, well, the answer is pretty simple. Stop doing what they tell you to do. And I'm not saying that, you know, don't be like some punk rock, you know, anarchist sort of. I'm just saying question, own your decisions, own your life, own your future. And they realize that this ain't working. So find something else.
Yeah.
That was it.
That's like one of the big drivers behind Beyond the Rut is, you know, like for my own personal life, you know, I was an army brat. So my dad was in the army for 20 years. I was born into that. My mom was from Thailand. So her only exposure to success in America was you join the army and you're a doctor. I guess the doctor part was more from her culture being from Thailand. So what is she trying to drill into her two boys? You're going to need to go to school. You're going to get good grades. You're going to become a doctor and an army officer. I'm like, okay. Yeah, I go through middle school thinking that, I go through high school thinking that, I go to college. I was recruited, oddly enough, for tuba performance, but I switch up at the last minute for pre-med. And then I get out of there barely with a 2.1 grade point average out of 4, for those who don't know the grade point average scale. Ideally, to get into med school, you got to be closer to the 4.0, and I was at 2.1, and that was because we replaced some grades with some new ones, and yeah, I just took the degree and ran, but I was not getting into med school. Joined the army, the one thing my dad said not to do. And I get out and I realize I don't want to be a doctor. You know, I went through 4 years of pre-medical education, 4 years as well, 4.5 years as an army medic, only to come out and realize I did not ever want to be a doctor. That was my mom's dream. And, you know, that started a whole process of like, what the heck do I want to do? And, our family wants food with a meal, so I better get a job. And so I've been in that rut where it's like, go to school, get good grades, get that corporate office, get that corporate job title with the six-figure income, and realizing I'm missing out on some cool things that I want to do in life because I'm following the rules. I'm following somebody else's dream. And that's why I wanted to have you on here, was just to hear it from somebody else's voice, you know, because I can't talk with an Australian accent. It's just cooler this way. it's like, you know, what is it like to break those rules and to create that your own path in a sense and go that way? Like what was that like for you?
Well, it's a blessing and it's a curse. The blessing is that now you're responsible for everything you do. The curse is you're responsible for everything you do. the truth is we were not born with a job. We were not born to be a pawn on somebody else's chessboard. We were born to be individuals and to pursue our lives and find our passion and find our purpose and get through this crazy, you know, experience, which is life. And that's how we are. And we seem to be really good at screwing that up. We seem to be really good at taking all of the fun out of things and turning everything into a chore. And then somehow in our minds, justifying our role in that and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm a team player. I'm part of a like in the military, you know, I'm following orders. I'm pursuing service to my country. Or if I'm a corporate worker, I'm on the team. I'm doing the mission of the company. We see that as being righteous. It's not righteous. It's somebody else's dream. We don't ever say, hey, what about me? You know, and at some point, what about me is scary, because for most people, it's funny, I was having dinner with some friends of ours last night. This subject came up. And if you realize that from your perspective as an individual, you can look externally or you can look inward. When you look externally, you see a world around you with people driving pretty cars and living in McMansions and kids going to the right college and everyone dressed up nice. And you think that's your external goal. That's your goal. You want to be a part of that, right? If you don't look inward, you sort of look inward and you realize there's nothing out there other than me. How do I feel? What is my responsibility to myself? What is my passion? What am I really going to be happy with doing things? What are my hopes? What are my dreams? What are my loves? What is my faith? What is my position in life? Who do I see myself as? My identity. I own that, right? It's not the Lambos. It's not the Bitcoin bros. It's not the big houses. And it's me. It's the inward perspective of self. The problem is that's the scariest thing people have to look at. Looking in the mirror at yourself is damn right scary. We do everything in our power to avoid it. We are distracted by, you know, these things. We're distracted by our job. We're distracted by our culture and what our society tells us to. And we use that as a crutch because we don't want to look inward. It's scary. When you start realizing when you don't have a job, when you don't have all of those expectations around you, and you have the time to sit and look inward, meditate, to be able to just sit on a bus for hours and just think, who am I? What is my goal? What is my passion? All of a sudden, your actual real self reveals itself. And when that happens and you start realizing that that's what you wanted to really do in life, not be a customer service operator at American Express, that wasn't your passion, you didn't get born into that, you start realizing all of a sudden, hey, I need to be put first here because I've got a mission. In Europe, and I'm not sure if it's still done this way, there used to be very common practice that kids that finished high school would go and spend 2 or 3 years backpacking. They'd just travel around the world. They'd go and climb, you know, Machu Picchu or live in Nepal or go to, you know, be a bartender in Tokyo or whatever. And what happened was in those 2 years, they started to not only see a much wider influence of what the world was all about, but they came face to face with their challenges of themselves, that they were in a country that didn't speak their native tongue, that they had to understand the differences of adapting to different cultures and making new friends and paying for rent and, you know, not carrying around more stuff because some gypsy will steal it in Italy or something. I mean, this is normal, right? But when you live that life and you come face to face with who you are, a couple of years later, you realize, hey, I'm pretty powerful. I can do crazy things. I went and lived in blah, blah, blah. I went and did this. I went and did that. It allows you to stand on the shoulder of those experiences and move yourself forward. And then if you move yourself forward in a purpose that is yours, that you own, that you feel is authentic, and that you are happy to get up in the morning and really excited to do what you do, you are unconstrained. You are successful. You can do anything you want. I had this conversation with a lady a few months ago here in San Miguel. She was from Arizona, where we have a home, and she was telling me, you know, about her life and all of the struggles and that she couldn't break free of it to come and live in a place like this. This is a magical city. I mean, a magical town. And she's, you know, she wanted to do it, but she just couldn't do it because, you know, she got the job and she got, you know, she did all this stuff. And I just listened to it and it was like, it was like weird because it was this experience like, why? Why? You know where you want to be.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? Maybe you didn't find where you wanted to be, but if that's the case, it's kind of like you got the cart before the horse. Maybe the first thing you should have done is worked out what you wanted to be, and then you would have had the time to pursue a path to get it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, and a lot of us will follow, again, somebody else's path. You know, it's like, I don't take the time to think about who I want to be, what I want to be, and therefore I'll just take the easy item off the shelf, or what I think is the easy item off the shelf, and then find out, you know, and yeah, I'm in a career I hate. I'm in a neighborhood I don't really like. I've got cars only to impress other people. And, you know, why am I doing this again? So it's amazing to, yeah, it's almost contrarian in a sense to pause and say, wait a sec, why is that supposed to be success for me? And yeah, what is
that's success? That's sad, actually, isn't yeah. it? When you think about it, it's contrarian. It's not the norm majority position to have no skin in the game in your own life.
Right.
Because you'll devote it to somebody else's dream. It's like, how messed up is that?
Yeah.
And yet that's what everyone does. It's sad. And the things that what I'm talking to is, if your listener right now was, say, an 18-year-old kid and wanted to know, well, what should I do when I grow up, right? Well, grow up's the first thing. And the second thing is go out there and find out what the world's offering you before you make a decision and commit to a six-figure debt load and student loan debt. Don't do that. Go out there and find out what the world's got. And you might be surprised how you can get to it much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to somebody older, you know, their mid-30s, late-30s, 40s, and all of a sudden they realize that they drank the Kool-Aid and they went through this, and now what? They're stuck, right? They can't get off the train anymore. They're on the treadmill. They got to get up to work every day. They're stuck in traffic and they've got kids and they've got responsibilities and they've got to live this, but they're miserable. What do they do? You know, the best education you give your kids is what you do, is what they see, not what you tell them. And if they see you doing that, what do you think they're going to do?
Okay.
If you really want to be a courageous parent, you need to be able to say, you know, it's the old thing you hear on the, when you get on a plane and they did the safety announcement and they say, if the mask fall from the thing, put yours on first before you worry about your kid. You kind of got to do that because your kid's going to learn 10 times more from what you do rather than what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're seeing you doing this every single day, you're the worst educator for your kids I've ever seen, because they're going to do the same thing. And that's sad. We've got to be more courageous. When I came to America, I was amazed by the culture, the people, the ability, the vision to be able to do huge things, things I could never imagine. And what I learned from those experiences were incredible. And I really think people don't take themselves, they don't give themselves enough credit. They're so powerful, and yet they just give it up to somebody else. That's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost forgetting that, I don't know, it's interesting in the sense that, like, we're giving up our autonomy for a sense of security. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to work for this guy for this paycheck. Well, I got to do whatever that person asks me to. And chances are that company has conveyed that message to them and they believed it through and through. And I remember being the opposite of what a previous boss of mine had expected, because that leader thought I was going to come in and just be at that leader's beck and call. And my attitude with that leader was, you know, I could walk out at any given moment. I don't have to have this job. And if we're talking about my first month on the job, not being with my family for the holidays, maybe I go back. Maybe I go back to where I was. And the guy was like, oh, we can work something out. And it was like, that leader tried to make me feel bad for wanting to put my family ahead of my career. And I was like, you know, when I die, and maybe that's how I got there, was more, well, you had a near-death experience in Australia, and that was kind of your aha moment. And mine was in a combat zone in 2003 and reading letters from family saying, hey, don't worry about your kids. We're taking great care of them for you. And I'm like, I'm supposed to be there. And, when I die, I would love for my family to say, man, Dad was there. You know, he wasn't the best dad. He wasn't the best person, but he was there and I could count on him being there. And maybe that's the story. Hopefully they pass on to their kids and their kids and so on. And I'm like, but if I pursue career first, I'm not going to have that kind of outcome. And it was that first aha moment for me to really think about, what will my family say about me when I do die? And how much of that can I control? And what do I need to do now to start creating that? And it's thinking about the end in mind is kind of a morbid thing to do in life, but I think it also helps. It can help kind of put those guardrails in place. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, what do you want to be? And if you're like, well, I don't know, well, think about when you're gone, what would you have wanted to be? And I think that'll help spark that conversation in your mind and take that time to introspectively get there.
There was something I mean, I've been very lucky to meet so many different people from all ages and all walks of life and all demographics and all income levels or whatever. And you understand, particularly with the older generation, I kind of culminated this into a simplification where I said, well, they're basically four quarters of life. And if that was to be based on, say, an average age of 80 years, well, as it happens, according to the CDC, the US male lives to an average of 73.5 years. So stop listening to them when they tell you you're living longer, you're not. But having said that, if we number 80 is easy because I can divide it by four, the way I looked at it was I saw the first 20 years of one's life is really under the auspice of the parents, because we are the champions of our children, and we're the guidance of our children, and they don't have yet these skills to go out there on their own and do these sorts of things. I mean, a few do, but it's rare. And in that quarter, your job is to learn how to communicate and socialize and learn and all of that. And then the second quarter comes about, and I call that the building quarter, where you're trying to build an identity, build a life, build a family, build a house, build a career, whatever it is. That's your next 20 years. That requires a lot of capital investment, like any startup venture would. You put a lot of money into that. You're going to buy that house, put that down payment down, student loan debt, whatever you choose that to be, you're going to capitalize it. The third quarter is an optimization quarter, where you now establish something that is pretty consistent. Maybe it's a family, maybe it's your home, maybe it's your career. You're just trying to optimize it. The goal at this point is to try to invest and make as much money that you can hide away like a squirrel in the winter. And then that final quarter, your waning phase, where you know that you're going to die and you know that you have an end point here. So the focus moves more to health. It moves more to quality of life and security, because you don't want to be a burden to others. And what happens is we go through these four quarters. And when you're in the second or the third quarter of your life and you're prepping for that final one, we sell ourselves out because somebody told us, some certified financial planner or whatever, somebody with a lot of letters after their name, is sitting there telling you, you got to throw all this money in your 401k and your IRA and you can't touch it till you're 59 and a half and all of this stuff, because God forbid, you've got to prepare for that final quarter, right? So you sacrifice everything you've got in life, all your opportunity for experience, your opportunity to challenge yourself, to go and go to other countries and travel and whatever. And you sacrifice all of that to get to that ripe old age of 65, where you've got a bad back, bad hip. You can't do it. You don't want to do it. You know, going and walking around, you know, Prague all day is going to hurt. And, but you do it because you think, well, I'm supposed to do it, right? The man told me I get to 65, I retire. What happens? Well, I'll tell you what happened to my father. He had a day job, like, you know, most people did. He worked for 40 years for the same corporation, and he worked as a roofer. He eventually became a roofing supervisor. He put roofs on big commercial buildings. And then he retired at 65 and he died at 67. I had to bury him. And so It was a pretty tough gig, and, you know, you do it, you step up. And I was 22, I think, when that happened. So what I ended up doing after he passed away is I had to take care of the estate, you know, for my mother. I had to make sure that she had enough money and everything was in place. So I went through every bit of paperwork I could find that he had, tried to piece it all back together. And what I saw was a story of a man that devoted his entire life to the corporation, to the company. When he died in, it's not an uncommon situation that people who retire, especially later in life, cannot mentally adjust to the anxiety that comes with that. They say retirement is, I think, the second highest stressor, or maybe third, but it's up there where the highest one is like death of a spouse. Mm-hmm. They say retirement adjustment is just a little below that. So if you're not 100% healthy, it's going to kill you, right? So what did we find he died of? Well, he was working for this company for 40 years. He actually died of lung cancer. And as we ended up finding, we had a heart attack, but it was from the lung cancer. The lung cancer came from asbestosis, or what you would call mesothelioma. He worked for a company that made asbestos.
Mm.
He devoted his entire life to that.
Yeah.
And nobody told anybody that this is dangerous, and it killed him.
Yeah.
Now, if you can't see that as the narrative of what not to do, And I guess maybe that underscored it, put the big underline under my own mission of what not to do. When I saw what my own father had gone through, I realized all of a sudden, don't do that, right? Don't listen to these guys. They're not interested in telling you your truth, your real truth. You've got to work that out for yourself. And, you know, I want to see people wake up. I want to see people realize, put themselves forward and be the champion for themselves and their family that they can be. I want them to realize that putting all your money away until you're 59 and a half is a stupid idea. You have no idea what the world's going to look like when you're 59 and a half. You have no idea what you're going to look like, if you're even going to be around. And if you defer all of those wonderful life experiences until then, you're going to regret it. And when you regret it and you go into life in the latter quarter of your life in regret, it's the worst thing in the world for you. That will kill you.
Yeah.
It's not the, you know, the obesity, a heart attack or whatever. It's regret. That is the biggest thing that will kill you. And all I can say is just don't go down there. I'm lucky I broke free of all of this mess. I did drink the Kool-Aid for a period of time. I put my daughter through college. I did what Americana society told me was supposed to do. It didn't really help her. It didn't really help me and my family. It wasn't until we went and did all these oddball contrarian things that we actually generated enough money and wealth where we could actually use it to do something more meaningful. And then having discovered that the world is a big place and 4% of the population of the world live in the United States and 96% don't, I said, well, let me go and find the other 96% and see what they've got. And here's the weird thing. I love the idea of timing. I think that's really the key of things. Get in at the right time. It certainly served me well when I was a young kid. I just stumbled into Mexico in a country which is on economic ascent on a path I've never seen before. You know, we stopped buying a lot of stuff from China and now a lot of it's being made here. And to see, you know, to see the society rising is and to be a part of that rise is an amazing experience. So happy I did it. And it's so peaceful and less stress-free and life's great, man.
Yeah, it blows my mind because you mentioned the idea that we are told by people with lots of letters after their name that you sock away a certain percentage of your income every single paycheck, that you don't touch till you're 59. It's like we're working ourselves hard so we could die.
Not be a burden to our government.
Exactly. Yeah. Or our family. It's like I'm saving up money so I can go into the healthcare system and live in assisted living and, you know, be as burden free as possible to everybody. It's like, man, and I've seen, you know, people who won't leave a job they hate because they have to keep building that 401k. You know, they're putting up with a toxic leader that's really impacting their health and their family relationships. Again, because they've got to build that nest egg for the future. And I've seen the guys, like even when I was still in the Army in my early 20s, I remember taking a Space Available flight from Germany back to the States to visit my family. And there was a group of retirees. They were well into their late 60s, maybe 70s. And I overheard them talking because we wound up on an adventure. Like we got stranded in Dover, Delaware and planes, trains, and automobiles to get to Washington, D.C. It was really cool. But I got to overhear their conversation that there were about four or five of them who couldn't make this trip because they have to be within a certain range of their hospital or their physician, their specialist, and they couldn't be outside of that range. And that life has been like that for them for the last decade or so. And I thought, man, you know, these guys, you could tell they've dreamt about doing this worldwide travel together. And now there's a good handful of them who can't because they're bound by a geofence in the sense that they have to be by a doctor. They have to be by a certain service. They don't have the mobility to go where they need to go. And I thought, man, that sucks. I don't want that for me. And so again, that wake up call in Operation Iraqi Freedom, it's like, I got to live. And you know, people ask me why I go out to the woods, ultralight backpacking for a week. You know, I think the most I've done is about 4 days, but they're like, why do you do it? There's like bears out there. And I'm like, the chance of an encounter is low. Like, what about mountain lions? They're not where I'm going. And what about this? It's not going to happen there. What if somebody tries to attack you? I'm like, again, low. Like I'm in more danger walking around the city than I am out in the woods. Just got to go out there and see it. And they're like, why? I'm like, because the sunrise is beautiful. The stars at night are big and bright. Sorry, that's for the Texans. Deep in the heart of Texas. Okay.
Hey, you're right. You're right. Look, ultimately, we are just another species, right?
Yeah.
We have to live in synergistically with everything else. We happen to be really good tool makers, so we became apex predators. I don't know if we'll ever stay that way if AI comes and takes us over or whatever. But regardless of all of that, you probably experienced at a young age the risks of finality by being shot at or whatever the situation you may have had in your service to country. When you go through that, I have a lot of friends who are vets, and the one thing that's common that I really can relate to with these guys is that you transcend it, right? You stop worrying about things and you focus on being in the moment, and that your own confidence with self can bring you through anything. See, we in Australia were raised that way because, you know, it's a very toxic country when it comes to, we're not the apex predator. Not when you're dealing with, you know, red belly black snakes and you know, funnel-wood spiders and you know, little octopus under a rock on the beach side that'll just kill you instantly. And I've been in ICU from things like that. So I kind of know what it's like. We're raised with that at a very, very young age. We're taught survival skills as part of our schooling. It's weird, but that's how it is. But you get to a certain point where you say, okay, I accept that that's how I am and these are the risks I'm dealing with. Now I have a mitigation strategy in my mind. How do I transcend that? And when you do that, when you hear people going, I get it all the time down here in Mexico. You know, you hear people who say, oh, I wouldn't go to Mexico. You know, the cartels have cut my head off, or the water will kill me, or, you know, I'll be kidnapped or something. And it's like, no, it doesn't like it. That's not how it is. It's not how it is. I'm probably safer here than I am in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at me going, what? I'm like, well, we don't have Walmart shootings.
Yeah.
We don't have, you know, school shootings. We don't have that. We don't have opioids being forced upon us by the medical industry that will kill us. We don't have any of that. We don't have a healthcare system where you can't see a doctor for 8 weeks because of schedule, or you've got to log into a portal. We don't have that. You just walk into a doctor. You need something, you go to the pharmacy. You don't even need a script. We take care of each other, and we don't have those issues. And I think if you add that all up, safety becomes a very different paradigm, and it's something where maybe we share in common. I'm sure I haven't had your experiences, but I will say that from a position of transcending and mitigating risk, we probably have a very common thought on that.
Yeah.
And I would just love other people to take ownership of the fact that maybe you're not all powerful that you think you are, and then learn to dance with it and learn to transcend and overcome it. And the world is then your oyster.
Yes. Yes, guys, gotta take this to heart here. Now, you've got a show called Be Unconstrained, and your website's beunconstrained.com. And I mean, you guys got to subscribe to that show because, I mean, his most recent episode, this will kind of date the show a little bit, is part one, How Much Do You Really Need to Retire? And I was in the middle of listening to that yesterday. I have to get back to that. That's a good one. That's good. The whole show's good. But, you know, before we go, though, any final words of wisdom you want to share with folks, even though we've packed this whole thing with wisdom?
you are powerful, right? And just accept that and learn to use it as an asset. I will say one thing, and I think this is a simplification, but it actually resonated with me a lot when I heard it. The rich don't have jobs. If you start realizing that if you're working for the rich and they're all the shareholders and you're just getting a paycheck, you're going to be doing that until the day you die. The only way you're going to ever transcend that is to go and buy assets that, like the rich do, that you can earn some dividend from and live off that. And the earlier you start that journey in life, the more likely you're going to be able to break free of these shackles. That's as simple as that.
Yeah. Awesome. Miles, it was great having you on here. And I think after this, I'm going to go out there and tell my wife, just to freak her out, that my goal now is to be your neighbor someday soon. You want to live where?
Why not? Yeah, really.
Oh, man. Thank you again, Miles, for being on here.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Wow. I hope you got a lot out of that conversation like I did. I mean, I took copious notes. I always do because I'm a note taker. Now, if you want to learn more about Miles and living that unconstrained life. You can check out the show notes for this episode at beyondtherut.com/408. There you'll find links to his resources that he offered up, as well as related episodes to this one, where I've spoken with other expats, people who've traveled the world, people who are living their lives unconstrained as well. And you know what? Also in those show notes, you'll find some resources. If you're in a leadership role, some resources on how to really boost the workplace climate where you work. So maybe you can't just pack things up and leave the country, but you can make life easier for the people who work with you, make it more fulfilling, and just show people you care about them, their success, and you actually create a space where people can feel safe to put out their ideas, to take risks, to even make decisions, just simple decisions on taking care of a customer without having to go through a bottleneck that is maybe you. And so if you want to lead confidently, you want to lead with purpose, you want to lead in a way where people know what you stand for, then you want to check out those resources. There's going to be a workshop I'm going to put up there, as well as a couple of freebies that may help you in your leadership career. So again, go to beyondtherut.com/408. You'll find that information there. And you know what? I'm glad you joined me for this episode. I look forward to joining with you again on the next one. But until then, go check out those show notes and go live life beyond the rut. Take care.